Yeah, I'm 30 seconds into my recording and we've already got our clapping done.
Yeah, this is fucking efficiency on a scale never before seen in
unprecedented focus for the both of us.
Yep. Truly incredible work we've done so far. Let's wrap it up. It's been a good episode.
Yeah, you know, I call this a top five episode.
Should we intro the podcast?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Or do we want to talk about some other random shit first?
Have you ever played Balatro?
No, but I've watched Hannah play it extensively.
Okay, because I've been addicted to it over the last couple of days.
Yeah, it looks cool. It's not one that I think I would enjoy playing, because I'm not a big deck building type person, but it seems cool.
Yeah, no, I am with you on that. I think deck building is a very specific thing that you have to be in a very specific headspace for.
Yeah.
And, you know, Balatro then requires an even more specific headspace because you have to be thinking about poker.
Yeah, I also don't know how to play poker.
You don't actually have to be able to play poker. You just have to be able to understand the composition of poker hands.
Yep,
and
don't
most
know.
Of them are self-explanatory.
Fair. Like, I've never played poker in my life.
What do you think is involved in two pair?
I think you might have two pairs of cards. That,
yeah,
just
pretty
going
much.
By the name. Going by the name, yeah, you got two pairs
three
of cards.
Three of a kind?
Oh, I think that's going to be like three of the same card.
Yeah, pretty much. You know how to play poker now.
Okay.
Okay, so let's intro this podcast and talk about the movie.
Okay. Hello, and welcome to Unsound Theories.
I'm Kat.
I'm Kira.
And we watch movies with no sound and no subtitles and try to figure out what the hell is going on.
Spoilers.
Spoilers. Even David Lynch doesn't know, and he made the movie.
Okay, that explains some shit.
Like, it makes more sense than Lost Highway, but it is very explicitly a movie that he's talked about as being one that is more a movie of subconscious than any actual, like, full fleshed out plot or meaning.
Interesting. That's a way to make a movie. Yeah, for sure.
So now I have my theories about this movie. Just in terms of, like, I think, because I've seen this before, and because I've seen everything David Lynch, and we're doing this because I wanted to get your reaction to what I think is one of the masterpieces of toxic Yuri in Western cinema.
Okay. I would agree with that assessment of it for sure. I gotta say, I didn't see it coming.
Mm-hmm.
I did not see the lesbian relationship happening in advance, and I also did not see them coming because they cut to afterwards.
Yeah, they faded to black.
Yeah. Were they supposed to be the same person?
The two lead women?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Okay.
They do look very similar, and I think that was a directorial choice that was made on purpose.
Okay.
Specifically okay. Because if we... So, I think one of the important things about this movie that you probably didn't pick up from the unsound version...
Yeah.
Is that in, like, the last...
Version.
The canonical version. In the last 20 minutes... they're playing completely different characters.
Oh. Okay. Yeah, that... that tracks, I guess. I was, there's a lot that happens in this movie that is just sort of there,
mm-hmm.
and it seemingly for no reason, just completely unconnected to everything else.
It's connected. There's a web. It's all happening in a weird sort of yarn that's being spun. Would it help contextualize the movie if I told you that the prevailing theory is that the first, 2 hours of the movie is a dream, hallucination, fantasy sort of thing?
No. No, that doesn't help.
I mean, just to explain why it feels disjointed and, detached from reality.
Yeah, I guess, why does she, who's doing the dreaming?
Naomi Watts 2.
Naomi Watts 2, okay, and why does she at one point randomly dream about, an assassination attempt that got gone horribly wrong?
Okay, so what we see happening is, you know what, actually, rather than having me explain it to you, because I've watched the movie and kind of have an understanding of it, why don't you tell me what you think it's about? Then I'll tell you what the theory is from the non-canonical version.
Okay, I don't know if this is going to make any fucking sense at all. In my brain, the two lead characters were the same person in different stages of her life. And
okay.
It's a sort of metaphorical representation of how she becomes a different person over time.
Interesting. I don't know that that is necessarily an incorrect read.
Okay. There's a couple of reasons for this. The main one that really kicked this theory off in my head is mm-hmm. the part where the other one, not Naomi Watts, cuts her hair and starts wearing a wig with that looks a lot like Naomi Watts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the point at which the point that they connect and they diverge from there in either direction.
Interesting. So did you pick up on the fact that Rita Brownhair had amnesia?
Yes, only because I happened to see the brief description of brief synopsis before I started watching the movie.
Because I think that does lend some credence to your theory that she wouldn't realize they're the same person because she doesn't remember who she is. But there's this convergence that is inescapable because she must always become herself.
Yes.
Because she's necessarily who she is. And who you yes. are can change depending on decisions that you make, but you will always become yourself in some way. Maybe not the best version, maybe not even a good version, but you have no choice but to become yourself.
Yep.
This is maybe going to be me at my most pretentious this episode, so I apologize.
That's fine. I'll balance that out by being me at my most bewildered.
It's a movie that lends itself well to looking for the themes that you are looking for.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it as a story about toxic Yuri, the lead character played by Naomi Watts alternatively goes by both Betty and Diane, which, if you might remember, is also the name tag on the waitress at the Denny's who looks suspiciously like her both times that they go to that Denny's.
I did notice they looked very similar and there was a lot of focus on that name tag.
Mm-hmm. So,
do you think she is the waitress and, the other one is a different person and most of the movie is the waitress fantasizing about being a part of the other one's life?
So, I think it's actually that the waitress is genuinely just a waitress, and in this fantasy, Naomi Watts at some point notices the waitress's name tag and takes Betty as an identity for this fantasy that she constructs.
Okay.
Like, there's a lot that's happening, but basically the version that makes sense to me is that we're seeing a story that is both toxic. It's two kinds of toxic Yuri. It's the one woman loves another and isn't loved back, so she, the unrequited love leading to like violent, how would you call it, I don't want to say violent ends because that's too Shakespearean, like violent jealousy,
right?
And then there is the toxic Yuri of the woman seeking fame and fame itself, who is always uncaring and unloving.
Okay, yeah.
And can only be toxic.
I can see this.
So Betty Diane, who in her Diane persona, who I believe is the real persona, constructs this elaborate fantasy where the woman she's in love with is helpless and dependent on her and loves her back because she has amnesia and can control her completely.
Yeah, that's, I would say, not a great situation to build a relationship off of.
And this is all still the fantasy, is that Diane has this fantasy immediately after she orders a hit on her now ex, who has moved on to start dating Justin Theroux.
Who the fuck is that guy? He looked so familiar. What else?
He's made
a movie that we watched.
No, but he's done a lot. Like, he was in American Psycho. He was.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
He wrote Tropic Thunder and Iron Man 2.
What is this fucking guy's name?
I'm trying to think of what else he's done. Like, but he's also a director. So, like, he was basically sort of playing himself, if you look at it that way.
I think I might have, bad at faces, melded he's him got in my brain with J.J. Abrams.
He does kind of have that vibe. He had a cameo in The Last Jedi as the Master Codebreaker.
Interesting. Okay.
The real one and not, what's his fuck? Benicio del Toro.
Okay. I don't remember that.
That's okay. I'm trying to think of, what else he's done.
For about the first half of the movie, I thought that was David Lynch.
I mean, yeah, that's not David Lynch.
I don't know what David Lynch looks like, and he was giving big director acting in his own movie vibes.
I mean, he is a director acting just in another director's movie. Hold on, let me get a video for you.
Okay.
Copy. Paste. This is David Lynch remixed slightly.
David Lynch remixed. Oh, okay. That's David. Okay.
That's David Lynch.
That's David Lynch.
If you can believe it. That was from his Twitter weather reports. He would do a weekly weather report where he'd report on the weather in LA.
Yeah.
During the pandemic.
Yeah, I remember. I never actually watched any of them. I did see a video where somebody overlaid all of them on top of each other.
Mm-hmm.
That was a nightmare.
A little bit. If you can believe it. I posted that in the Polycule Discord channel yesterday, and I posted in the Polycule Discord channel pretty much every Friday.
Nice. What in the hell were we talking about?
We were talking about the ways in which this movie, we were talking about the director man and what his deal was.
The director man, yes. Okay, here's a scene that was really set the tone for the movie. For me, it was early on. Directorman and some other guys were in, like, a meeting room.
Mm-hmm.
Directorman has a golf club for some reason.
A lot of white guys in Hollywood love to carry around golf clubs with them
to
practice their swing as an intimidation factor. Like, it's like, oh yeah, I'm going golfing after this and I'm practicing my swing, but secretly I'm also threatening you with this golf club.
I'm so glad I don't date men.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's also a very particular scummy Hollywood or, like, executive type vibe. It's definitely not a standard thing.
It's definitely something some of my coworkers would fully do. So they're in the meeting room and everybody is just sort of experiencing tension. And then a dude, one of them drinks some coffee and spits it out.
Yeah. So, Directorman?
Yes.
Was being threatened by the mob to specifically cast one of the mob boss's daughters in his movie instead of a talented and qualified actress.
Okay.
Now, like, the way that this is a manifestation of the delusion is that in real life, Diane's ex-girlfriend, Camilla, is dating Directorman after she broke up with Diane.
Okay.
And Diane also then did very much try out for the movie that Camilla ended up becoming famous from getting cast in.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, there's almost, despite the fact that Diane thinks she's a better actress.
So it's so like a justification. Like, obviously the only reason she was picked was because the mob was involved or something.
Right. And it's the same with the bungling hitman who is, like, the hitman later on in the movie, too. It's this fantasy that this hitman is so bad at his job that he'll get caught before he can actually kill the girlfriend now that she's paid the money for him to kill the girlfriend.
Okay.
And it's like this whole idea that, like, she's constructed this fantasy where things will eventually work out for her. And then the fantasy sort of comes crashing down when she realizes that Camilla is already dead because she's got the blue key.
Yeah, what was that?
So there are two blue keys. There is the blue house key and there's the blue triangle key. The blue triangle key.
That was like alien psychic tech, right?
Yes. And/or the triangle blue key was actually her waking up out of the delusion.
Okay. Yeah.
Which coincides with where it switches over from her being Betty to her being Diane.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. My next question is, why is there a man who's just sort of in a room that's too large and not well lit? Because he's the human alien hybrid psychic who is sort of orchestrating all of this. He's the one that created the triangle key box.
Okay, interesting. I wonder if he's sort of meant to be representative of the secretive Hollywood power players who in Diane's fantasy are keeping her from being a successful actress.
That's one theory. I don't know that
there's as much evidence for it as there is for the
hybrid alien who's part of an invading force who's killing people using a mysterious box that if they open it, they die.
They die and they come back as a woman named Diane, who is just a complete mess.
Yeah, we call... Okay, here it is. It's called the Jackbox. And you know that song about Jack and Diane? That's a warning about this invasion.
Oh, interesting. What about the Jackbox party pack?
That's propaganda by the aliens to get us to like the Jackbox.
Interesting.
Yes.
What does this then have to do with the jerk-off box? Because that's technically also a jackbox. It's a jacking box, but nonetheless a jackbox.
Right, right. I think it's the same box. It serves two purposes. If you wish to, instead of like resist, so basically the way this invasion works is you jack off into the box, the jackbox, and they use your DNA to create an alien hybrid with you, and then you die.
Interesting.
And then the hybrid takes over your life
and changes your name to Diane.
Yes.
Okay, so did you also notice, sorry, this is a complete aside, Director Man's wife was cheating on him. Did you notice who she was cheating with?
No.
It was fucking
dude?
Billy Ray Cyrus.
Oh my god.
It's Hannah Montana's dad.
Do you think this is in the Hannah Montana verse? And that is when Hannah Montana was conceived?
No, because this movie, just based on fashion, very clearly takes place in 2001.
When does Hannah Montana take place? I don't actually know.
Okay, let's find out, to quote the owl from those Tootsie Pop commercials. Hannah Montana, 2006 to 2011.
Okay.
Which means that...
So it's not inconceivable that it could be set a few years into the future from when it was made.
So Hannah Montana, you mean?
Yes.
I haven't watched enough, but I have to imagine.
There's really no way to know. And that's why Hannah Montana leads a double life, because of the hybrid clone.
So are you saying that Hannah and Miley are alien hybrid clones of... But then why does she go by Hannah Montana and not Diane Montana?
That's such a good question. I think since it does take place a number of years into the future, the invading alien force did realize that it would get a little bit suspicious when, like, a quarter of the world's population is named Diana, and changed that sort of parameter on the box.
I guess that is... Maybe they just fixed the name dial.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was previously stuck on Diane.
Yeah, yeah. The random name generator wasn't working. They like fucked up the coding a little bit, and so it was just outputting the same name every time. And eventually they realized that and were like, "Oh, this isn't gonna work." So they fixed it. That's the Jackbox 2.0,
or the Jackbox Party Pack 2.
Jackbox Party Pack 2, yeah. And there have been several iterations since then.
Yeah, I think they're up to 10.
Yeah, yeah. And each one becomes obviously more and more complex and sophisticated and insidious. So listeners, don't play Jackbox. It'll clone you.
It'll clone you into someone named Diane.
Yeah, well, if you play the first one, yeah.
Oh, that's right. Only if you play only, the first play Party the first Pack.
One. Yeah. The other ones, you're safe. As long as you don't come while you're playing it.
Are you telling me you've never come while playing TKO?
That's the thing. It's like, that's part of the insidious trap, is you can't not.
Yeah, you know, your friend draws a really bad Shadow the Hedgehog with the caption, come.
Yeah, and you think that's your friend, but that's the hybrid clone of your friend who's drawing the Shadow the Hedgehog, specifically designed to make you come, to trap you into the... box.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
What a wild and crazy world we live in.
I know, it's actually kind of crazy.
So
hopefully I haven't ruined this movie for you.
No, there's literally no way to ruin this movie, because it's like actually sort of, so the thing is that there's no canonical explanation for this movie. David Lynch says it's there, but there's no actual canonical explanation.
Okay.
So yeah. You could be right.
And I think I am, because obviously watching the Canonical Unsound Theories version gives us greater insight than the wider release version that was edited to have sound against David Lynch's wishes.
And, like, yeah, so, like, the idea that this is a movie that, like, very specifically doesn't have an explanation and may not even have a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's very fascinating.
Yeah, and it doesn't have, there's no, like, plot explanation or mystery because it's a fucking documentary to warn us about the Jackbox.
David Lynch does seem like the kind of person to do that.
Yeah.
Now, there's a whole other theory
okay.
that I think we want to delve into, and that is a parallel universe theory.
Okay.
Because that's a running theme through David Lynch's works.
So it's like the movie takes place in two different parallel universes?
Correct.
I can see that, yeah.
And by unlocking the blue box, this alien technology, Betty transports herself to that second universe where she is Diane. And then, because she is the Diane of that universe, she's forced to live out what is Diane's life.
That makes sense. Yeah. I think there's room for both of these theories to exist at the same time. I think that perhaps the invading alien force is not from another planet, but it is from an alternate version of Earth. And when you are replaced by a hybrid clone, you yourself are sent to their reality. They swaparoo you.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, because their reality is starting to fall apart as a result of their incredibly powerful psychic powers that are sort of disrupting reality, and they're basically trying to swap realities with us because they've ruined theirs.
Hmm. So now,
it's a metaphor for capitalism and imperialism.
That is fascinating, because I think a lot of David Lynch's work is directly metaphorical for, like, the, what you would call, like, alienation of the American experience.
Mm-hmm. That definitely tracks within what I think we can agree is the established definite reality of what this movie is supposed to be about. I think we cracked it, Kat.
Okay, but I'm gonna throw a wrench in here.
Okay.
What if Rita, the amnesia character,
mm-hmm.
is meant to be an audience stand-in? What if she is us? What if we had lesbian sex with Naomi Watts?
I'm willing to consider this.
Like, the fact that she her search for meaning, her search for identity, is the same as our search for meaning in this film. And she disappears at the end of the movie before she can come to a conclusion about her identity and who she is.
Hmm. Okay, yeah.
Which is why she disappears right before the blue box. That makes
sense.
We, by forcing ourselves to find meaning in this film, lose ourselves in the narrative of the film. That the quest for identity and meaning is ultimately one where you either become someone else,
or you get replaced by a hybrid alien clone of yourself.
Or, sure.
Those are the two options in life.
So, one of the things that I did want to talk about with this,
okay,
was just the visual delight, what I consider the visual delight of the way that David Lynch builds sets.
Okay.
Yes. Like, specifically, like, if we look at the imagery here, it's mostly empty room with pinpoint lighting.
Yeah.
Like two pieces of furniture and then curtains on the walls.
It definitely sets a tone, for sure.
It's like a very beautifully surreal sort of, like, it's almost backrooms if backrooms were good.
Yeah. And I think it is really, there's a lot of really pretty sets in this, that's for sure. If I'm to relate this specific room design to the true and canonical interpretation of this movie, what I see going on here is This is the head alien psychic man. He may or may not be a hybrid. It's possible he's not a hybrid. And he is like the one alternate earther who has fully entered our universe so far because of the immense psychic forces that are tearing apart their universe. There's local distortion in reality around him here, and that's why the room makes you feel so uneasy.
Interesting. Now, did you know that David Lynch has also released a couple of albums, including an album titled Crazy Clown Time?
Okay.
It's a complete non sequitur.
That's alternate title for our podcast.
Crazy Clown Time. Okay, let's take that intro one more time.
Hello and welcome to Crazy Clown Time.
I'm Kat.
Beep, beep, boop, boop. I'm Kira.
Guh-huh. And we watch movies with no sound and no subtitles and try to figure out what the hell is going on.
Oh shit. You know what, Kat? Okay, here's a sort of podcast admin question. Now that we've done a second podcast intro inside this episode, can we still legally do another podcast intro for one of our intro-less episodes?
Legally, no, because technically we're not doing an episode of Unsound Theories anymore. It is Crazy Clown Time.
Okay, so within Crazy Clown Time, we've only introduced one podcast, so we can still do an intro. Okay, yeah, okay.
Except that we'd be doing an intro for a different show, and I don't think we can do that because that's intellectual property theft.
It could be a cross-promotional thing, like it's a crossover episode.
I haven't negotiated that with myself, so I don't think I can do it.
Okay. All right. So what's your favorite brand of clown car? For like, if I'm in the market for a car to have a lot of guys come out of, what do you recommend?
So it depends on how you want them to come out, right? Like,
true.
Want them to come out as non-binary, gay, girls?
I think sort of like,
if you want them to come out as girls, it's the Subaru Brat, hands down.
I think that's the answer, yeah.
what are your favorite balloon animal techniques?
I really love the twist and squeeze. I think it's better than the squeeze and twist.
Just
sort of in terms of like the body mechanics, it's a lot easier to execute and a lot more efficient. And when you're doing like a few hundred balloon animals for an insane kid's birthday party, you want that efficiency.
That's true. Now, how do you feel about what I call the balloon animal shortcut?
Every kid gets a snake. Now, we've certainly ramped up the efficiency with this one. And I like that. I think it can work in a certain setting of kid's birthday party. If it's snake themed, that definitely works. If it's reptile themed, also works. If
it's mammal themed, you really can't get away with giving it snakes.
You could call it a you could call it a ferret.
You've got to still
ferret.
That's a little depressing. I don't know if we want to do.
Again, it really depends on the tone of the party, but I think.
Okay, consider a parasite themed, not the movie, but the like living type of being, parasite themed birthday party.
Okay.
A nematode themed, maybe even.
Yeah.
And you give out, you inflate your balloon animals and you say, here, kids, it's a tapeworm.
Okay. Yeah. I think you could also, for some added fun, you could stuff a couple of uninflated balloons into a balloon and then inflate it. And then
and
the
it
parasite
can be a
has
digestive
parasites.
Tract. Yeah. Or it's like, it's like, if you get, so the outer balloon is going to have to be pink, right? And you stuff it with a bunch of white balloons.
Yes.
And then you kind of, you can do a little bit of twist on it, give it like the vibes of a large intestine and be like, look, you've got a tapeworm.
I think that's perfect. I think
The kids are gonna love it.
And we're registering that. We're patenting that for sure.
TM.
I'll call up the clown patent office as soon as we're done recording this. We should probably, like, before someone even hears it and gets ahead of us, we should probably end the episode. So thanks for honking.
We sure didn't. Okay, and now we're back to unsound theories.
Yes.
Okay, so. I didn't get to make a clown egg joke, but that's fine.
That's fine.
Do you want to know what this movie is about precisely?
I do, yeah, for sure.
Okay. Mulholland Drive is a 2001 surrealist mystery film written and directed by David Lynch. It tells the story of an aspiring actress named Betty Elms, newly arrived in Los Angeles, who meets and befriends an amnesiac woman recovering from a car accident. The story follows several other vignettes and characters, including a Hollywood director. Injured and dazed, the sole survivor of a car crash on Mulholland Drive, a winding road high in the Hollywood Hills, walks into Los Angeles and sneaks into an apartment. Aspiring actress Betty Elms arrives at the apartment, normally occupied by her Aunt Ruth. She's startled to find the woman, who has amnesia and calls herself Rita, after seeing a poster for the film Gilda, starring Rita Hayworth. In Rita's purse, Betty finds a large quantity of cash and a distinctive blue key. At Winky's Diner, a man tells another about a nightmare in which he encounters a horrific figure behind the diner. When they investigate, the figure appears and the man collapses. Mobsters insist director Adam Kesher cast an unknown actress, Camilla Rhodes, as the lead in his film. He refuses and returns home to find his wife Lorraine cheating on him. The mobsters withdraw his line of credit, and Adam meets a cowboy who urges him to cast Camilla for his own good. A bungling hitman attempts to steal a book of phone numbers and leaves three people dead. Now, we haven't talked about this cowboy at all.
We really haven't. The magic cowboy.
Because he just kept showing up.
Yeah.
Maybe the magic cowboy is a good alien trying to prevent the alien hybrid clones from being created.
That's entirely possible, like a sort of resistance force. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And because his head is a different shape than humans and he hasn't really gotten the disguise quite perfect, he wears a 10-gallon hat.
That tracks fully.
Okay, easily explained. Betty and Rita are served at Winky's by a waitress, Diane, causing Rita to remember the name Diane Selwyn. Finding Diane Selwyn in a phone book, they call her, but there's no answer. Betty's audition is highly praised, and a casting agent takes her to Adam's soundstage, where he's directing the Sylvia North story. Camilla sings, "I've told every little star." Adam capitulates to the mob by casting her. Betty locks eyes with Adam, but flees without meeting him. Betty and Rita go to Diane Selwyn's apartment, where a neighbor answers the door, saying she and Diane switched apartments. A very normal thing to do.
Yeah, definitely, totally, for sure.
At the neighbor's apartment, they find a woman who's been dead for several days. Back at Betty's apartment, Rita disguises herself with a blonde wig, and she and Betty have sex. Rita awakes at 2 a.m., insisting they go to Club Silencio. The MC there explains in different languages that everything is an illusion. Rebecca Del Rio begins to sing the song Crying, the Roy Orbison song, in Spanish, then collapses while her vocals continue in playback. Betty finds a blue box in her purse that matches Rita's key. Back at the apartment, Rita retrieves the key and finds that Betty has disappeared. Rita unlocks the box and it falls on the floor. Aunt Ruth enters the room to find no one there. Diane Selwyn awakens in her bed in the apartment Betty and Rita investigated. Her neighbor says two police officers are looking for. She looks exactly like Betty, but is a struggling actress in a deep depression due to her failed affair with Camilla Rhodes, who is a successful actress and looks exactly like Rita. At Camilla's invitation, Diane attends a party at Adam's house on Mulholland Drive. Diane says she came to Hollywood from Canada after her aunt died and left her some money, and that she met Camilla at the audition for the Sylvia North story. A woman who looks like the Camilla Rhodes who auditioned for Adam kisses Camilla, and they turn and look at Diane. Adam and Camilla prepare to announce their engagement, but dissolve into laughter and kiss while Diane watches teary-eyed. Diane meets the hitman at Winky's and hires him to kill Camilla. He says she'll find a blue key when the job is completed. The figure from the man's dream has a matching blue box. In her apartment, Diane looks at the blue key on her coffee table when someone knocks on the door. Terrorized by hallucinations, she runs screaming to her bed and shoots herself. A blue-haired woman at the theater whispers, "Silencio."
Okay. Well, they've left out all of the subtext, but that is, like, what
pretty much bang on for
in the movie.
Yeah. So apparently included with the original DVD release, there was also a David Lynch's 10 Clues to Unlocking This Thriller card that came with the DVD.
Fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like me to read them? Yes, please.
Number one, pay particular attention in the beginning of the film. At least two clues are revealed before the credits. Number two, notice appearances of the red lampshade. Number three, can you hear the title of the film that Adam Kesher is auditioning actresses for? Is it mentioned again? Number four, an accident is a terrible event. Notice the location of the accident. Number five, who gives a key and why? Number six, notice the robe, the ashtray, the coffee cup. Number seven, what is felt, realized, and gathered at the club Silencio? Number eight, did talent alone help Camilla? Number nine, note the occurrences surrounding the man behind Winkies. Number 10, where is Aunt Ruth?
I'm always asking myself this.
Now, it's, like, extraordinarily important that David Lynch refuses to confirm if anyone has ever been correct.
I mean, that... Obviously, the aliens would kill him if he confirmed.
Right, right.
So he has to maintain some level of plausible deniability.
And, you know, there is also the general fact that David Lynch just generally refuses to elaborate on any of his work.
And I can respect that.
And I think, particularly, I think that's a very admirable thing for someone to do vis-a-vis enforcing death of the author.
Yeah.
Like, the film is what you make of it when you interpret it.
Yeah.
If you insist on there being a correct interpretation of the film, you've missed the point of viewing art.
That's fair. Yeah. I'll allow it.
It's whatever David Lynch might say about the movie, there is no correct interpretation. Because even if he says, this is what I intended, that doesn't make other reads of the film wrong.
True. That's true. I like this movie more after we talked about it.
Yeah, it's a fun one, and I do encourage you to watch it again with sound.
Yeah, I'll see.
Because there's a lot that you miss. I also want to take a little bit of time, because this is, you know, my shtick. This has a lot of very similar themes to Twin Peaks: The Return.
Interesting. I did see in one review that it takes place in the same alternate reality as Twin Peaks.
I think that's just someone theorizing.
Okay.
But, like, I do love the way that, like, the theme kind of gets elaborated on each time David Lynch has a chance to sit down and really make something interesting.
Yeah.
Thinking about, like, various other David Lynch works, like, you know, obviously Dune is probably his most straightforward work because it's adapting a story.
Yeah.
But, like, you go to Blue Velvet in 1986, you have this, like, mystery that's happening, and there's so much weird, surreal nonsense up to and including the weird sort of psychosexual Dennis Hopper stuff that goes on.
Psychosexual Dennis Hopper stuff, you say?
Oh yeah, it's great. I do think you would also love Blue Velvet. He's got, like, this really extreme mommy kink.
Nice, nice.
To the point that he refers to himself as baby. Like, baby need bottle.
Oh, okay.
It's
interesting.
It's great.
For a second I thought you were talking about Dune, and I was like, fascinating.
No, I'm talking about Blue Velvet.
Okay.
Also, first movie that I've ever seen where a guy just goes wild huffing poppers.
Is it Dennis Popper? Do you want some reviews?
Please.
All right. Andrew gives us 1 star. Titles review. One of the worst movies I have ever seen. And it reads,
Andrew has no taste.
Yeah, well. This movie is useful only in that you can pretend to like it to impress other people who pretend to like bad movies for clout. It is boring. The acting is terrible. Yeah, I get it. It's supposed to be. The cinematography is amateurish, and I couldn't have cared less what happened to any of the characters. Use this movie to instantly determine whether someone you are talking to is a genuine human being or a no-personality miscreant fated to follow the influence of the mediocre.
You know, he mentions fated to follow the influence of the mediocre, yeah?
Yes.
Who the fuck is he, if not the mediocre?
Yeah, I think he's telling on himself there. Like, he shouldn't... Don't listen to my review. I just have to get this out there for me. On some Pretty level, much. He knows. Yeah. Our next review is from Surly, who gives it 1 star, and titles the review Pretentious. And it reads, what a bunch of pretentious drivel the pro-Mulholland Drive reviewers have spewed forth in the reviews of this film. I agree with those that found the film to be at best a chore to view. Despite what the other reviews said, this film is hard to follow, and I watched movie to be entertained. If I wanted to work at understanding something, I would just as soon read a textbook on quantum physics or organic chemistry for entertainment. The end result would be similar. The only redeeming social value to this film are the nude scenes.
Actually, speaking of which, were you surprised by the lesbian sex?
Yeah, did not see that coming.
You're welcome.
So thank you for that. I needed that, honestly. Our next review is by Laura McGuff, who gives it 1 star and titles the review Sound Quality is Awful. And I've included this because it's just so relatable. It reads, I would probably love this film if I could hear it.
Oh, yeah. That, so just to be clear, that is very intentional.
Fair.
Like, the movie is mixed really, really, really quietly.
Oh, I hate that. Why would they do that to me?
Because it's David Lynch.
Okay. Joseph gives it 2 stars, titles review. It wasn't good and I wouldn't recommend it. And it reads, a movie about how Hollywood chews and spits up actors and actresses and does so by one-to-one doing that to the viewing experience. Time to Buy gives it 2 stars. Titles review, too twisted, too deep. And I think this lends credence to my theory about the invading aliens because it reads, so deep that it is not made for humans. Then we've got a 3-star review from Robert William, who titles it, Reviled in Jersey, Enjoyed in L.A. And we've got a narrative here. So, enjoy
I'm
this
delighted
one.
By that. But it was not reviled in New Jersey when I watched it in New Jersey.
When this flick first went to DVD, I tried to rent it at a Blockbuster in New Jersey. Forget about it. The minimum wage rack filler in charge that night refused to rent me the DVD. He had even cleared all the copies from the racks and was holding them in the back room. There was no way he was going to rent this. By his assessment, the worst movie ever made, to me or anyone else in the Garden State. He was actually angry about the film's existence. Why? He was adamant that there was absolutely no story to be found in the whole film. The movie was just a jumble of disjointed and pointless images and vignettes meaning absolutely nothing. The whole thing was obviously some sick Hollywood freak's practical joke on America, stealing 2 hours from all our lives for a tossed garbage salad. 2 hours of precious life we would never get back. In his opinion...
It's actually 2.5 hours.
I know, right? It's so fucking long. In his opinion, director David Lynch should be prosecuted post-haste. The overwrought clerk finally agreed to let me have a copy at no charge, if I could, upon the morrow, upon returning the movie, relate to him any shred of story, plot, or meaning in the mess. He would put the movie back on the racks. In the morning, I told him, it's a sardonic, black-humored modern update of The Wizard of Oz, with Wendy being a wannabe actress in Hollywood. A car accident on Mulholland is the tornado that kicks off her extended moment before death by suicide. moment of her hallucinating the reasons for her not becoming the hottest new movie star in town. The hallucinatory narrative goes back and forth between the true reality of her failure, she's a mediocrity, not particularly talented, special, or connected, and her wounded alibi. She imagines she has been sabotaged by dark forces of both movie industry and possibly supernatural variety actively conspiring against her. In a weird way, this movie is a far more realistic fictional documentary of how dreams are sucked into a dry, desiccated death by the Hollywood machine than other more conventionally told cautionary tales. If viewed through this alternative Oz lens, the movie is quite sad, fun, and hypnotically watchable. Well, the Blockbuster clerk would have none of my slick West Coast explanations, so the DVDs stayed in the back room, and New Jersey remained protected from Lynch's evil film assault on logic, rationality, and American goodness. Naomi Watts is wonderful in this, by the way, as she is in almost everything.
She's also really good in Twin Peaks The Return.
Good to know.
She plays Janie, who is Dougie's wife, and Dougie is an alternate universe Dale Cooper.
Nice.
Because the thing about Twin Peaks The Return is that it takes place in like four or five different universes, depending.
I have two more reviews.
I would like to hear two more reviews.
Daniel Reyes gives this 4 stars and says, and titles the review, Say Watts. I assume that's going to be play on like, say what? But it's Say Watts.
Say Watts?
Say Watts! And it reads, At first, I was not sure if I was understanding the plot of the movie. The girls really kept me watching, so I kept watching. Of course, waiting for both girls to do it. But then I realized that I was being so promiscuous with my thoughts, so I started to try to understand why Bella was in love. I was trying to understand why she became crazy. Then I wanted to understand what was going on. I was lost, but at the same time, my attention was held hostage. I think I might watch it again tonight to understand the full concept of this film. I recommend for those who like this type of complex, insidious, surreal, creative films.
That's the first, I think, good review that this has gotten from the reviews he read out.
Last one, Mark Roberts gives it 4 stars and titles the review, Edited Copy? And Mark is asking the real questions here. They say, I think my copy has been edited. In the scene where Laura Herring drops her robe, her body has been brush faded so that there is only flesh tone where her bush would be. I don't think it was like that when I first saw it.
So is this person is complaining that there's not enough bush in this movie?
Yes.
Literally the only acceptable complaint so far.
that's all the reviews I have for you.
Okay. So let's take a second here and ask ourselves, would you sound?
I would sound, yeah.
I mean, I'm already a have sounded, so...
I would watch this. If I had 2.5 hours of my life, which I don't because I'm insanely busy lately.
And it's a 2.5 hours that demands you pay attention to it.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's
like, it's not a movie where you could be like, oh yeah, I'll play a roguelike while I'm watching this, you know?
Yeah. I changed work schedules, and so I've been far more busy and exhausted than normal, which is probably partly why we've sort of dropped the quantity of episodes for this podcast.
I've also just been very busy because my work schedule has been killing. Like last week was coming off of a holiday. Was it last week or 2 weeks ago? 2 weeks ago, we were coming off a holiday.
Yeah, it's been a taco time.
Stop it. And sorry, we're coming off a holiday. I'm getting bothered by Taco, aww, who's decided it's time for him to get fed 3 hours early.
Listeners, if you want more podcast episodes more often, go ahead and pledge like a few $1,000 a month to Patreon so we cannot have jobs.
Yeah, if you go to our Patreon and pledge, like, what's the minimum for both of us to quit our jobs and do this full time?
I'd probably need somewhere like 3,500 a month at least.
Yeah, so at $8,000 a month, both of us will quit our jobs and you'll get weekly episodes of Unsound Theories.
Yeah, so go.
Do it.
Do it. You know you want to.
What are you waiting for?
Do we want to do...
run, don't walk, to your computer and give us money.
Please. I don't want to go to work.
I'm not saying please. This is not a request.
Exactly.
It's a demand.
No, this is that. That's a.
And kids, if you're listening, you should go to your parents' wallet and get out those funny green pieces of paper and mail them to us.
we're at 3624 Mulholland Drive.
Disclaimer: I was doing a soupy sales bit. Don't actually mail us money.
Yeah. I think we should fulfill our contractual obligation and intro the 50 Shades of Grey episode.
Yes.
Hello, and welcome to Unsound Theories.
I'm Kat.
I'm Kira.
And we watch movies with no sound and no subtitles and try to figure out what the hell is going on.
Spoiler, I didn't come.
Dom jeans.
Dom jeans.
Okay.
But yeah, so we did it. We're working through the backlog, and I think
we're almost caught up.
We're not. We have 1, 2, 3, 4 more to go, I think.
That's almost caught up.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so can I convince you to also commit to watching all of Twin Peaks and then, like, 10 hours of Twin Peaks The Return?
Probably not.
Okay.
That's fair. I don't have that much free time in my life. I could do that, but it would have to happen over the course of like 9 months.
That's actually fairly reasonable. And there's a lot of episodes of Twin Peaks you can skip.
I don't actually know how many episodes there are.
30.
Oh.
Halfway through season 2. They fired David Lynch for some reason.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. So it just gets bad because they forget that David Lynch makes weird things with intention.
Uh-huh.
And they just let it be weird for the sake of being weird.
Huh. Well, that's a choice, certainly.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And then they bring him back for what was at the time the series finale to try to save the show by making a really good cliffhanger. He makes a really good last couple of episodes, and the network canceled it anyway. And then, 25 years later, Showtime brings it back.
25 years later.
Very genuinely 25 years later.
Didn't that happen with something else recently?
Frasier.
Didn't that happen with something else that was actually good recently?
Original Frasier was good.
Okay, I'll allow that.
Revival Frasier, not so much. Because Kelsey Grammer's got into his weird conservative freak phase.
You hate to see it. Should we...
I just got distracted by a post on Tumblr of our energy drinks. Someone made an energy drink popsicle.
Interesting. I bet that tastes awful.
I would drink it.
Which energy drink did they use specifically? Was it a mix?
Monster Zero Ultra.
Okay. The only one I really like anymore is the Monster Australian Lemonade.
The Australian Lemonade is very good. What was the... There's like a bunch of really fascinating Monster Ultra flavors, and what I've come to realize is that the Ultra brand of Monster is Monster's attempt to court the cigarettes and an energy drink transsexuals as a part of their market share.
Yeah.
And you know what? It fucking worked. Because I drink so much of the Monster Ultra.
It didn't work on me. Sorry, Monster.
Well, you also don't smoke cigarettes.
Also true.
Which, you know, is part of the appeal. Taco, can you please stop turning on my work computer?
Mom, it's time to work. And by work, I mean
get me some
food.
Okay, check this one out, though. They made a bisexual Monster can.
Okay. Nice.
Ultra fantasy.
Ultra Fantasy Ruby Red is Ruby Red grapefruit flavored, but it's artificial grapefruit flavor, so it won't fuck up your medication.
That's good. I was about to ask. That's an important consideration.
It is. Anyway, thanks for listening.
We sure didn't.
Goodbye.
Bye, squad.
That's not gonna go to put in the episode. That's so weird. Unsound Theories is made by Danger Square Productions. You can follow us on Tumblr at Danger Square Media, or follow Kat and Kira on their respective Tumblrs at ZaftyKat, that's ZaftyKat, and Sapphire-Mess. The best ways to support what we do are leaving 5-star reviews on the podcatcher of your choice, or telling a friend about the show. If you'd like to support us monetarily to help us keep the lights on, you can visit dangersquare.ca, where you'll find links to our Patreon. The music used in this episode is Dance on All the Cell Phones by Chris Plaustil of Sounds Like an Earful. Visit soundslikeanearful.com to hear more of Chris's tracks. Until next time, thanks for listening, because we sure didn't.